With respect to Joseph's question, this is the way I formulated these things in What is Systematic Theology. The overall category is doctrine, by which I mean the teaching of the church. The church is teaching at any given time. It's all doctrine. Some of that has to do with the mysteries of faith. So when the church is teaching about Christ and the Trinity and the divinity of Christ and the resurrection and the redemption and so on and so forth, most papal encyclicals as church teaching will have to do with the mysteries of faith. Most of it has to do with that. The latest encyclical of Pope Benedict XVI on the Christian meaning of charity. Okay, it's a mystery of faith. Now, some mysteries of faith have been expressed in dogmatic formulae. But not all of them have. There is no dogma about redemption. No Catholic is going to deny that there is redemption in the cross of Jesus Christ. There would be different interpretations of what the meaning of that is, but no Catholic is going to deny that, and yet it has never been formulated as a dogma. So, some of the mysteries of faith have been formulated in dogmatic pronouncements, starting with Nicaea, and then down through Ephesus, Chalcedon, and so on, Trent, Vatican I. Okay. Now, this is the meaning of dogma in the actual formulations of the First Vatican Council. The First Vatican Council uses the word dogma to refer to mysteries of faith so hidden in God that we would not know them at all had they not been revealed. So dogma does not, for Vatican I itself, at least in the interpretation, it's Hermann Pottmeyer, P-O-T-T-M-Y-E-R, German, still very much alive, person that Greg and I both met in Rome at the time of the modern centenary celebrations at the Liberian University. Pottmeyer is referred to by Lonergan in Method and Theology when Lonergan himself takes over Vatican I's statement about the meaning of the word dogma. But there are other teachings about the church that have to do with the mysteries of faith that have never been expressed in dogmatic formulations. That doesn't mean they couldn't be, but they haven't been yet. The resurrection is another example of that. It's definitely part of church teaching, it's part of Christian belief and so on, but there hasn't been a dogmatic pronouncement on the part of a pope or a council where it's been claimed that this is infallible doctrine and so on and so forth. And yet, certainly, I mean, without the resurrection, the common understanding is that everything would fall apart, as St. Paul himself said and as Christians have held since. Okay, now there's other church teaching that doesn't have to do with mysteries of faith at all. A lot of the moral teaching of the church is moral teaching. Okay. Now, what has for Lonergan a permanence of meaning, not an immutability of formulation, but a permanence of meaning? Well, permanence of meaning attaches to the dogmatic formulations of the church. That doesn't mean we have to continue to use exactly the same language, but we cannot go against or say something contrary to the meaning of those statements, or we would be heretical. For him, that's what heresy would be. Would be affirming a meaning that is contrary to the meaning expressed in the dogmatic formulations. Is that clear? I think this works. The one controversial point about it is this what dogma really means? But when Lonergan is able to appeal to the First Vatican Council itself, hardly a bastion of liberalism, the First Vatican Council. I mean, it's a very conservative council. And that this is the way that the First Vatican Council used the term dogma. It gives it some ballast, I think. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't, in the creed, we include many things that have not been given dogmatic formulation. In the Nicene Creed, some of the Nicene Creed is the dogmatic formulation of the Council of Nicaea: God from God, light from light, true God from true God, and so forth and so on. That's taken right out of the language of the Council of Nicaea. But for us and for our salvation, that's the redemptive thing. Okay, that has never been put into any kind of dogmatic formulation. Fred Crow has speculated that perhaps we will need to have a dogma concerning the resurrection. Perhaps the church is in a position today where that may be emerging as a need, that there has to be some kind of a dogmatic formulation with respect to the resurrection. Because of, I suppose, a lot of the 20th century stuff, well, the resurrection was that the disciples came alive. Okay, they did. But they came alive because he came alive, you know, and not for any other reason. And so maybe that has to be said more strongly. And I think Fred might may be right on that. Anyway, that's the way I would break down the difference between. Yes.
I'm insisting a lot in questions in this chapter because it's more pertinent to my context. I'll make a question, specific question is in Latin America there's a big dialogue with critical theory of society from Habermas and Frankfurt School. And even one of the modules of theology of liberation is a critical questioning of practice. In the critical theory of society, you question your assumptions. You always question your assumptions, and you always ask questions about where you're standing. In Lonergan, it looks like when he takes Ricoeur's hermeneutic of suspicion, I think he's doing something similar. And when he's talking here about dialectics and foundations as functional specialties, is trying to do something like that. Can you specify a little bit more about this? Because over there, it's very important to not be naive about your assumptions, and they criticize a lot the North American or the European theologies because they don't take into assumption their context, the assumptions of the context, and the ideologies of the context.
Okay. Where Lonergan will contribute to that program is in terms of intellectual, moral, and religious conversion. So the assumptions that he is always pointing to are the assumptions that have to do with what one thinks one is doing when one is knowing. The assumptions that one is assuming with respect to what is moral integrity, and the assumptions that have to do with religious living. Both critical theory and the theology of liberation have added another set of assumptions that I think are not explicit in Lonergan, and they have to do with the social structural dimensions of the context out of which one is speaking. And from my own standpoint, that definitely has to be a part of the hermeneutic of suspicion that would be brought, that has to be exercised with respect to one's own, you know, that something that I have to be aware of. And that's one of the reasons that in Theology and the Dialectics of History I tried to make the bridge from Lonergan to liberation theology by grounding the preferential option for the poor in this analysis of the scale of values, where the scale of values is presented by Lonergan. And I didn't extend it at all, but I pushed the meaning of it to the central insights of liberation theology and said that partiality for the poor and the oppressed is not contrary to the mindset that Lonergan characterizes Cosmopolis, but is intrinsic to that mindset. I don't think he would have any objection to it when it's put that way. I really don't. But did he go that far explicitly? No, he didn't. Does that help at all?
Yes, it's a lot.
So, on the other hand, you know, I guess what I also want to say is that any theology that would discount the dimensions of assumptions that Lonergan points to is taking a big risk, you know. So that the intellectual, moral, and religious. I don't think the full position on conversion is expressed by intellectual, moral, and religious conversion. I think I've already added a whole dimension called psychic conversion. And I think the social has to be drawn out. It's at least an implication of all four, if it's not a distinct dimension of conversion. But I also think that any position on conversion that does not take into account intellectual, moral, and religious is also missing the boat. So you can have a critical theory of society that can be Marxist or whatever, but if it doesn't acknowledge the possibility of authentic religion, if it doesn't conceive morality in terms of self-transcendence, and if it doesn't conceive knowledge as a matter of experiencing, understanding, and judging, that position is not going to be adequate to what we need. So I would hold very firmly that Lonergan's offering essential integral elements to the position on authenticity and conversion, and therefore to a critical theory of society. But I don't think he's giving the full picture. But I also think that any liberation theology or whatever that would deny the points that he is making, I would have serious difficulty with. And I'd be suspicious about where that's coming from. What kind of ideology or alienation is responsible for that? Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So, but I think that the issues that are raised by the critical school and so on are crucial. At the same time, you know, we had the seminar just a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, yesterday. Cameron Thompson did a Girardian reading of Habermas, and it was, I don't know whether you've had a chance to read his paper yet.
Some part of it.
It's quite provocative, I think. It really is provocative. It's the most, I've always been extremely sympathetic to Habermas. I think Lonergan was sympathetic to him, but this is introducing a suspicion with respect to Habermas's whole program that I think really has to be answered. I think Habermas has to at least answer it. And it's all with respect to a whole dimension that was present in Horkheimer and Adorno that Habermas brushes aside, doesn't take seriously, the whole matter of mimesis and ressentiment. And how that primordial level of the distortion of desire can distort communication and render Habermas's whole project impossible if it is not addressed. That communication, undistorted communication, cannot take place if, in fact, there are operative in the efforts at communication undisclosed and unappropriated mimetic rivalries. Then the Habermas's communicative action is covering over. It's a cover story. That doesn't mean that it has to be. But again, just as I thought 30 years ago that if you talk about intellectual, moral, and religious conversion and never face dramatic bias, could be presenting a cover story. So I think you can talk communicative action and dialogue and discourse, but if you're not dealing with these elemental things that go on between people in communication, and you don't confront the possibility of manipulation at a very elemental level, then your theory could be a cover story, and it would never lead to where Habermas wants it to lead, which is to a community beyond violence. Because where is what Girard has done? Girard overextends, perhaps, his claims, but what he has done has definitely shown us one of the major sources of violence. It may not be the only one, but it is a major source in this mimetic rivalry that takes place at a very primitive level in our psyches.
See, in Latin America, Girard has already arrived in the faculty. It's known very well. But in Colombia, we have some contacts with anthropologists that come from the south, from Argentina.
Yeah.
And there is a person, Maturana, an anthropologist, that has developed a theory according to some data about humanity in a certain, I don't know exactly the moment or the moment of development, but there is an era or a moment of humanity that they had to go through such a difficulty. I don't know if it was because of the ice age or something, that there was no way to survive but with a very profound sense of solidarity. And we're rescuing that, and we're restoring that over there. Because, like in Colombia, we're talking all the time about violence. We know we are violent. So some people just say, we just have it in your genes. It's part of ourselves. So over there, we're looking.
Oh, I think that's very important. And I think that could be something to offset the overemphasis in Girard. Girard, as came out in the seminar a couple of weeks ago, he's not too sharp on human nature, okay, and he tends to see everything as sin unless it's grace, okay, and even in a Catholic anthropology, it's sin, nature, and grace. And I think that this solidarity, you know, would be a good thing to, particularly if it's being studied, if it's being presented in the sense of something that happened in the primitive stages of the emergence of humanity. Because what Girard has is what emerged in the primitive stages was murder. Period. He doesn't have anything else. Okay, so. I think that there is more that is necessary. I think that's true. So this could be very healthy for him as well. All right, I think we should move to the other one. Can we move to a questionnaire on philosophy? We won't get through it today. This is a remarkable piece of literature, which was, you know, the review just came out of this book in Theological Studies in the latest issue, which just arrived here in Canada, at least just last week. And he refers the reviewer, Jeremy Wilkins, who was a teacher's graduate, reviewed the book. But he refers to this piece particularly as a remarkable thing that Lonergan, when he wrote it, never intended it to be published. But how could you not publish this? It has so much in it that is so, you know, what philosophy is. It states it in a way that he never states in any other piece. Okay, so we move then to his response to a questionnaire that Jesuit Central Headquarters in Rome sent to a number of people on the question of the philosophical training of Jesuits. And as I put here, little did they expect that they were going to get an answer like this, you know, because they ask these questions, how much philosophy and how little, and, you know, what's the minimum and all of that. Well, he just goes to town on this. And first of all, he says there's been a breakdown in Jesuit philosophical training. Even though that philosophical training had both pluses and minuses in the past. But the breakdown, Lonergan would explain, first in terms of underlying and long-standing causes, namely the radical shift in the notion of science in the 17th century and the radical shift in the notion of history in the 19th century. In many ways, those were two aspects of one great transition from the medieval to the modern. But a more proximate cause is the failure of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, to grasp the radical character of these developments, of this single momentous event demanding an equally momentous development in philosophy. We have tended to regard it as a series of regrettable aberrations that unfortunately were widely accepted, instead of, as Herbert Butterfield said, that the rise of modern science is the most important event since the emergence of Christianity. Philosophy in this modern context, then, for Lonergan, is the basic and total science, Grund- und Gesamtwissenschaft. And as such, it's philosophy that mediates between theology, other sciences, human cultures, and societies. For Aristotle, the basic and total science is metaphysics, the science that sets forth necessary principles and conclusions about being as being, principles that hold for every being. But the scientific and historical revolutions challenge the view of science on which this position rests, the classical notion of science as the true and certain knowledge of necessity through causes. The basic set of terms and relations yielded by modern natural science were far more fruitful than anything that could be derived from Aristotelian metaphysics. And the methods of such science differ vastly from the procedures of Aristotle's posterior analytics. Furthermore, science is now acknowledged to lie not in the individual, but in the community. And as for history, Aristotle had no idea of the procedures of critical history, nor did Thomas. They became commonplace in the 19th century. So, for Lonergan, the basic and total science is not just metaphysics. It is the compound of cognitional theory, epistemology, the metaphysics of proportionate being, and existential ethics. So then he says, this is how he starts this response. And then he says something about each one of those. Cognitional theory, what am I doing when I'm knowing? Cognitional theory, he says, includes the whole genesis of common sense, of the sciences, of exegetical and historical studies, scholarly and philosophic developments. So cognitional theory says what is knowing in each of these areas. What is knowing in natural science? What is knowing in exegesis? What is knowing in historical studies? What is knowing in scholarly work, human studies? What is knowing in philosophy? It ensures our basic and total science against objections from the sciences of the past and leaves it open to the discoveries of the future. So the first thing is to be as familiar as you can with knowing in all of these areas. Now, nobody can be on top of the whole thing, but insight can give you a great deal of help. And then when he adds the hermeneutical dimensions of interpretation and history later, he's gone a long way towards giving a clue as to what knowing is in all of these different areas. Epistemology, why is performing the operations set forth in cognitional theory, why is that knowing? Epistemology then takes the reader or student beyond mistaken views on knowledge and reality. For Lonergan, mainly knowing is taking a good look at what's already out there now. Knowing is not that. Knowing is the correct understanding of experience. Okay? That's what knowing is. And that's what goes on. It goes on in common sense. It goes on in science. It goes on in scholarship. It goes on in philosophy. Metaphysics is a corollary that sets forth what in general we know when we perform cognitional operations. What in general we know is the universe structured in accord with central and conjugate potency form and act. Existential ethics. Here he's speaking of this in the discussion, in the context of the discussion of theology. So notice he's not presenting ethics any longer as something that can be done purely from a philosophical standpoint. He's discussing it within the context of theology. The Christian religion on the side of the subject is the transformation of existential ethics. What is existential ethics? It's the ethic of a living that has not yet emerged in as much as one just drifts through life. In as much as one just says and does and thinks what everyone else is doing and saying and thinking, and especially when everyone else is drifting too. Positively, existential ethics is the ethical living that begins when one finds out for oneself that one has to decide for oneself what one is to do with one's life, but that becomes established when one lives in love with those nearest one and in loyalty with one's fellow human beings about one. Such existential ethics undergoes a transformation when God's love floods our hearts through the Holy Spirit He has given us. For such love is unrestricted. It is with all one's heart and all one's mind and all one's strength. It is comprehensive, loving God above all and one's neighbor as oneself, and the world in which we live with all it contains as God's own world. It is the love described by St. Paul in the 13th chapter of the first letter to the Corinthians. It is the love to which Ignatius of Loyola directs those that follow his spiritual exercises. All of this quote from Lonergan. The Christian religion sublates the whole of human living. For what sublates goes beyond what is sublated. It adds an entirely new principle, sets a new goal, a new task, a new criterion, liberates what is sublated from its limitations and directs it to higher ends, yet in no way stunts it, interferes with it, robs it of its integrity. Within the individual, the Christian religion is God's love flooding one's heart and thereby transforming one's existential subjectivity. Within the ongoing human community, the Christian religion is the objective revelation of God's love in Christ Jesus, the mediation of that revelation through the Christian community, and the mission to preach the gospel to all nations until the consummation of all in all. Theology thematizes that Christian religion as lived. So theology is reflection on and thematization of the lived Christian religion. We have seen, he says, that the Christian religion as lived is the sublation of the whole of human living. It takes everything up into itself. It follows at once that to thematize the sublation of the whole of human living is a task beyond the competence of theology as a particular discipline or science. That theology can perform that task only by broadening its horizon in uniting itself with philosophy as the basic and total science. So a theology that would have only general categories, special categories, only categories that are theological, is not doing its job, because it's supposed to thematize the Christian religion as the sublation of the whole of human living. And so it has to, if it's going to do that, it must have some categories to talk about the rest of human living. And where does it get those categories? It gets those from philosophy as the basic and total science that integrates all of the other sciences. So special and general categories, with the special grounded in the Christian religion as lived and the general in the basic and total science, corresponds by analogy to what you have in Aquinas, where the special categories are taken from the theorem of the supernatural and the doctrine of grace that follows from that, and the general categories are taken from Aristotle's metaphysics. The basic and general science results from understanding, both in their similarities and in their differences, the several methods of the particular sciences, and as well the procedures of common sense. Only in virtue of such understanding is the theologian capable of thematizing adequately the Christian religion, both in itself as a principle of sublation and in its effects upon the whole of human living. So what he's saying to the Jesuit superiors here is, if you want our people to do decent theology, well, you better give them some decent philosophy. In this new context, theology is the sublation of philosophy. For philosophy is the basic and total science of human living. The Christian religion as lived is the sublation of the whole of human living. Hence, the Christian religion as thematized, theology, is the sublation of the basic and total science of human living. There follows a wonderful expression of an opinion on the relevance of philosophical study in the preparation of candidates for the priesthood and in the training of Jesuits. And the opinion is expressed that in such a context, philosophy and theology should be taught together, a practice that even today only some Jesuit provinces have implemented. We have a situation here in Canada where there's a house set up for the philosophical training of Jesuits, set up by the Canadian Jesuits, and that this year they started to bring Americans into the program. Well, the Americans are doing their philosophy together with their first year of theology. So they're studying the two together. The Canadians hadn't been doing this. And so you've got differences in the same house, setting up programs for them and so on. So now the Canadians are going to start doing what they should have been doing 10 years ago. Anyway, Lonergan would want, the question was raised, what's the minimum? You know, and he, of course, he hates questions like that. But anyway, what's the minimum? Religious, moral, and intellectual conversion. That's what the minimum is. That should be required of all Jesuit students. This core requirement may be expressed and communicated in several quite different styles, symbolically, analytically, through definitions, systematically, methodically. But then he says, you know, thinking in terms of the minimum, that leads to minimal results. The minimum is dull and uninspiring. It offers no challenge. It brings no real benefit. It's regarded as drudgery. And it's endured only because it's authoritatively stated to be a condition sine qua non of ordination. This is so true about, you know, the people. Once that condition is fulfilled, it's forgotten. And the only regret people have is that they had to put up with it in the first place. But he says, rather, offer people, plan a maximum, provide them with brilliant teachers, encourage them all to make the most of their opportunity, to do the best they can. Keep them at their books, though, only as long as they're making progress. If they reach a point and they can't go any further, that's enough. Or perhaps long enough for them to discover their limitations. But give them something that's worthwhile. Instead of, well, what's the minimum? What's the, how can I get out of this? Then the question, what about Marxism? Do they have to know about Marxism? Well, his answer to this is they have to know about theories of history, including Marxism. But the Catholic Church has to work out its own theory of history. And Lonergan presents his own heuristic in terms of progress, decline, and redemption, relates that heuristic to both liberal and Marxist doctrines, and he takes some of that heuristic from Marxism. His whole thing on group bias was definitely his appropriation of Marx. But he said, in brief, what priests need today is not an understanding of Marx so much as an understanding of the dynamics of history and the vital role that Christians are called upon to play in that. Marx will offer something to that. He does. There is another context in which I heard Lonergan say that what we need to do with Marx is what Ricoeur did with Freud, to advance the positions and reverse the counterpositions. What about the human sciences? Well, he has this distinction between human sciences and human studies. Human sciences are concerned with discovering universal laws, while human studies, such as interpretation and history, are engaged in understanding particular texts, particular processes, particular people and societies. Both are cognitional activities that the philosopher has to thematize, but there must be two separate thematizations. So, in other words, the humanities, what we call the humanities, is mostly human studies. Human sciences, like economics, psychology, sociology, can be done more rigorously, seeking the laws. But human studies are also part of the education of the human being. The human sciences bear some analogy to the natural sciences, whereas the human studies are analogous to the development of common sense. I don't think we need to do too much more with that question. Number 24, the question moves to method, and Lonergan presents his own as a thematization of what happens all the time. Knowledge of such method becomes a necessity when false notions of method are current and more or less disastrous. For instance, scientific method, the notion of scientific method as a mechanist determinism would be a good example. The basic and total science is also basic and total method. It is reached only by performing the operations of such particular disciplines as mathematics, natural science, common sense, human studies, adverting to the operations so performed and thematizing them, adverting further to the dynamism linking related operations and thematizing that dynamism, thereby arriving at a normative pattern for each of the particular methods and through them to the common core of all methods, namely the dynamic structure of human coming to know and coming to decide. Then they said, well, what about systematic thinking? So Lonergan responds with a few paragraphs about what is meant by system, only to conclude the following. Empirical science is systematic not in the sense that it offers a system valid for all time, but in the sense that it offers a succession of provisional systems, where each later system satisfies the known data better than did its predecessor. Now, I've argued in What is Systematic Theology that we have to think of system in theology in the same way. It will be a succession of provisional systems, where the later ones will account for more than what the earlier ones did. But in generalized empirical method, we get another meaning of system. The basic terms and relations are different from the basic terms and relations in natural science. They're verified in a singular fashion. In the ordinary case, and I'm going to go through this, so I will, let me read the statement that he makes here first. This is in terms of verification. In the ordinary case in science, the hypothesis is the antecedent, A. Its implications are the consequent, B. And the confirming data correspond directly only to the consequent, B. So you get a scientific hypothesis, the law of falling bodies, S equals whatever, GT squared, whatever the formulation of that is. That's a hypothesis. All right, if that's true, then the following implications. And then you test, and the testing confirms the implications. So A is the hypothesis, that's the antecedent. The consequent are the implications. The testing confirms the implications. The testing does not prove the antecedent. It just doesn't disprove it. Okay? It doesn't do anything more than not disprove. It doesn't prove the antecedent. It simply confirms that it might be true. And that's the ordinary structure of scientific verification. But in generalized empirical method, in what he takes us through in Insight, both antecedent and consequent are given in experience. The antecedent in the thematized operations and processes, the consequent in the publicly performed methods of particular disciplines. So, again, in the ordinary case, revision involves change in a theory, but not change in the object to which the theory refers. So scientific theories will change, but the objects don't change. The theories explain the object better, and that's why there's a change. But the revision of the central core of generalized method would involve a change not only, would change not only a theory about human knowledge. I copied this wrong, and I didn't even notice it when I went over at the screen. But also, I mean, basically what it's saying is that it would involve a change in the very subject that's performing the operations. So what he's trying to get at here is that human knowledge is a matter of experiencing, understanding, and judging. And that is all itself experienced. That all comes within the realm of experience. The law of falling bodies is a formulation that it itself is not experienced. What's experienced is you can watch things drop. You can measure the time that it took. You can measure the distance that it took. But you don't experience the law. But here you're experiencing yourself experiencing, understanding, and judging. You're understanding yourself experiencing, understanding, and judging. You're judging that, in fact, you are experiencing, understanding, and judging. There's a self-transparency about the whole process. And if it were different, you'd be different. If your knowledge were opening your eyes and knowing everything, well, you wouldn't be a human being. Human knowledge is experiencing, understanding, and judging. So to revise the central core of that method would entail a revision of a person doing the knowing. So the basic and total science is empirical, yet in some sense not strictly hypothetical. In some sense, its central core of experiencing, understanding, and judging is not open to revision. The isomorphism of knowing and known follows on the analysis. That's how he sets up his metaphysics, as does the structure of authenticity, the four basic precepts, be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. They're isomorphic with the four levels of consciousness. They're independent of cultural differences. And to these four, he here adds a fifth, acknowledge your historicity. I also think that isomorphic with the levels of consciousness is the scale of values, vital, corresponding to experience, social to understanding, cultural to reflection and judgment, personal values to decision, religious values to the gift of God's love. So there's an isomorphism there. And there's a fundamental sense in which this is not subject to basic revision. It's subject to all kinds of refinement and new articulations, new implications and all of that, but not to basic revision. What about pluralism? Well, there's the pluralism of common sense. That's always going to be with us. You go from, take a train in Europe sometime, and you go through five different varieties of common sense in a day. You know, there's the pluralism of perspectivism in exegesis and history, but there the differences can be minor. The grave differences arise from philosophic, moral, and religious differences. Such pluralism can be mitigated by conceiving exegesis and history as functional specialties, by adding further special functional specialties, dialectic and foundations, to objectify these graver differences. There's the pluralism of systems. The pluralism of systems for Lonergan is a problem only if a particular system claims to be the only system. Well, that system would have a problem with other systems. But otherwise, I mean, when I'm doing systematic theology, I have no problem with the fact that somebody else is seeing things in his system or her system that I don't see. Because I learn from that, and then I can incorporate that. There's going to be a pluralism of systems. It's only if I think that the only system is the one that I'm creating that I would have a problem with somebody else creating something else. The pluralism of philosophies that are methodical. The key issues are horizon and conversion. The specification of the horizon may fall short of the objective at which we aim. We have to be converted from assumptions about the real and the good. Teachers of the cognitional theory, epistemology, metaphysics, and existential ethics should themselves be converted and should be able to organize their courses so as to communicate their own conversion to others. Freedom in philosophy entails following the method, whereas departure from the method means people are no longer really philosophers in the sense in which Lonergan's intending philosophy as the basic and total science. But following the method is a matter of creativity. And one can, by following the method, add to the method, can enrich by adding elements, adding quite new dimensions. And he very kindly refers to psychic conversion as an example of that, that someone, by following the method, discovered something that could be added to the method itself. It's a very nice thing for him to say. Thank you. And then he, how should future professors of philosophy, well, we don't have time to discuss that. We can take a question or two, but we don't have to go on too much longer. It's a great piece of work. Really,
I wonder if it has been paid attention to.
You know, to me, I can say this, and I know I'll be quoted, and that's all right. The real irony is that they set up a program for philosophical studies for Jesuits in this province and didn't pay any attention to this. And are not. I mean, if they get Lonergan in there, it's by happenstance. It's not planned to make it available. To me, that is just a lack of development. But they didn't. Why didn't they read this and try to implement it? That would be setting up a program, philosophical studies.
I was tempted to make a Xerox copy of this and send it to the faculty.
You should. Good. That's a good temptation. Okay, good. Thank you.
We will do the
philosophy and the religious phenomenon, and you take a look at horizons and transpositions, just so we don't get into the thing where we each week fall another week behind, and we won't get through everything. But philosophy and the religious phenomenon is another wonderful piece. which we discovered after Lonergan's death. Was never, he never published it or anything. We discovered it after he died.
Much been done.
So he says from the four levels, this is in the next one. From the four levels of intentional consciousness, all of a sudden we've moved to six levels.
No.
But the first and the top are not intentional. They're non-intentional. Anyway, we'll get into that next week.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's exciting. That's, we're done.